There's a lot of shit environment. Going on. It's a tough environment.
It's a tough environment, and we fight it out, and
and we drop F bombs and S bombs and B bombs and C bombs, and I mean, I think there might have only been a couple of F bombs. Definitely a lot of S bombs on this interview. But anyway, it gets spirited.
No pun intended.
But it's all okay. It's it just goes with the territory. You will see.
I'm Steve Giordano.
I'm Bob Allen.
This is Cockpit Casual, the podcast. We're just going to stay silent now.
Yeah, after I think that. So. I'm trying to think what number it is.
It's nine.
It's nine. It seems like we just did the podcast.
Yeah. I feel like, so I was thinking about doing like basically a season and calling a season 12 episodes and then maybe not taking like a break. But like, you know, the summer is going to be a little tough. We might go to every other week in the summer or something. Maybe. I don't know. Yeah. We'll play it by ear and see how it goes. I might start with season 2 at episode 13. So a little housekeeping we're gonna have note to play for it. Everybody.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. I mean, we're just going to have to play it by ear this summer, I think.
Yeah. And plus, we got some other things that we're doing, too, that are for mass consumption. So we'll see how that goes. It's going to keep us busy. But don't worry. Yeah. We're sticking around. I mean, I think... the weekly thing is we're going to try, and we've been good so far. And you know, if we have to drop off a little in the summer, we'll keep you posted. But I am going to have a nice cockpit casual for you at the beginning of the summer.
Yeah, and there will be all the other content that goes on out there.
Yeah.
Lots of – we'll hear Steve ranting on X.
Yeah, well
– stay tuned.
You can just tune into X for that. My rants and raves. So we have actually a really cool episode for you today. We're going to BS for a little while like we normally do. And then we did an interview today. I don't know if you could call it an interview as much as it was like a gaggle. But we brought the core members of our operations team on and we had a chat today.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Their first time probably being on a podcast, and it actually flowed very well.
It was comedic. It was funny. So you guys will enjoy it. We had Mark Lawrence, our dispatcher, Chris Fochuk, who's our manager of planning, and Wes Gardner, who's our VP commercial, slash project manager, slash Asia manager, slash all purpose, do it all.
Where's
very
all the hats?
Tall guy.
He's my bodyguard as well.
Yes.
What is he like? Six.
He's 6'5". And he's big. I mean, the dude is like, I mean, he should have been an offensive lineman.
Or a wrestler. He should have gone into wrestling.
Like pro
wrestling.
He's
a hockey player.
Yeah. Yeah. Supposedly he was a really good hockey player. His kids are both really good hockey players.
Yeah.
So
people have probably seen him on Cockpit Casual or other content.
Yeah, people know Wes. I mean, he's Wes is like the face of Nomadic, really. I mean, at least in person at all the trade shows.
Yeah. Yeah, he hits all the trade shows. I think more of our clients know Wes more than us anymore.
Yeah, it's a good thing, except for the OGs. So lots going on. I have been in several Twitter feuds over the past couple of days. I mean, honestly.
Yes. I've just been watching from the background.
You know, I can't help myself sometimes.
I know. I find it entertaining, honestly.
You know what, though? Honest to God, man. I don't think this is so much going to be on partisan lines. I know people accuse me of being... you know, a libtard or whatever people say. I'm really not. I'm actually so middle of the road. I kind of hate all politicians, to be honest.
But. that's both of us. We actually hate all politics.
Yeah.
It's just all BS. We just don't like, you know, BS.
Right. No BS. You know, it's funny. Like,
give us
you
a
know,
straight
the,
truth.
The canned response is if you criticize Trump with all the people, I mean, he does so much stuff that's worthy of criticizing. And you know, you're starting to see people that are not of my political persuasion, whatever that is, start to say, okay, come on now, right? And I am seeing that. I'm seeing a lot of like level heads are prevailing with a lot of this nonsense that's been going on lately. So, you know, it has been good to kind of see that. So I wouldn't say that I'm embattled in like legit Twitter feuds. I try to avoid that nonsense, but
I don't think you usually don't go down the political road. I mean, it usually has something to do with aviation.
Yeah. Well, people turn pretty much everything on Twitter into political, right? And this is kind of this rant stems from politics. We're talking the spirit thing. And I want to spend some time talking about that today and apolitical. I want to talk about the problems with Spirit Airlines and why throwing good money at bad is not a good solution in this case, especially our money, our taxpayer money. Lord knows we've paid enough of those taxes. But, you know, the response whenever I have something critical to say about this administration is, well, Biden, blah, 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 Biden, you know. Guess what? Okay. I don't care. I'm not like a fanboy of Biden. I'm not a fanboy of any real politicians at this point in my life. I liked Obama a lot, but anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. So is what you're saying is you don't think that Spirit would be a good investment?
That's what I'm saying. Spirit would not be a good investment for the United States of America or any investor with the money to spare to give it a cash injection, because the Spirit is a flawed model, and it hasn't always been. Honestly, Spirit's been around a long time. I mean,
Where do you think they went wrong?
Well, I mean, let's go through the numbers, okay? But first, let me start by saying Spirit's kind of an OG. Low-cost carrier or ultra-low-cost carrier, right? I mean, the MD-80 days, Atlantic City hub, you know, flying these niche routes, offering a low-fare option for people that don't want to drop a fortune on a ticket to go down to Florida or go to the Caribbean, or, you know, flying the old MD-80s with a similar business model to Allegiant worked. And it paved the way for quite a bit of success in the earlier years for Spirit Airlines. And let me first clear the air about a couple of things, because I've been accused of, you know, wishing bad on Spirit because it's going to help us from a business perspective. Let me throw that out right now. First of all, yes, we are lined up to start repoing Spirit aircraft if need be by our lessor customers. I could care less whether we do it or not. Domestic ferry flights are more trouble than they are profit.
It's not even a moneymaker. Yeah. I mean, we barely make anything with that. It's really not.
It barely covers our costs. We move domestic operations in order to secure the long hauls where we make our money.
Yeah. So, the bottom line is we certainly don't, wish death on a carrier so that, you know, we're going to go out and make a few dollars. I mean, that's definitely
Some of our closest friends are or have been employed by Spirit. My good friend is a sim instructor. He's been there for forever since USA 3000 folded, if you remember them. He's based down in Florida. Great guy. He was my original flight instructor. Then he was my chief flight instructor when I worked under him as a CFI. Just a great, great dude. Lots of friends at Spirit. I mean, one of our equity partners at Nomadic was a Spirit pilot. He's at UPS now.
Yeah. Taylor. He's got lots of friends there. I know.
John Rico was at Spirit.
And a bunch of friends that are still at Spirit.
Yeah. And let me also, in clearing the air, say that, you know, this business, this job is hard enough. You know, you work your butt off making no money, just struggling to build flight time. You get hired at a place. You hope you can settle in. I mean, look, I worked for some of the worst airlines imaginable, by all metrics. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to see people lose their jobs, especially in this job market, because there's not going to be other jobs. And let me make something clear. If this price of oil remains above $100 a barrel, the economy continues in the direction that it has been due to a variety of issues, Spirit's not going to be the only one. It may be the first one, but it certainly won't be the only one, and not even in the United States. I mean, you're going to be seeing the struggling airlines start dropping like flies. And it's going to happen soon because $100 a barrel oil is unsustainable by any airline business model. Any. Yeah,
you're already seeing some of the European carriers already cutting back flights.
Yeah.
And potentially doing early lease returns.
Yeah. So let's talk about why Spirit is a flawed model and why it's become a flawed model. For one, in order to be successful, you either have to be enormous. And by the way, I use the term successful when it comes to the airline business very loosely because it is a low margin business. Even the best performing airlines financially are, what did you say American Airlines profit margin was? You were telling me earlier.
I think their operating margin is less than 3% and their net margin is like 0.2. I mean, and that was 2025 numbers. That's not even what's right now with oil. They basically just operate to service their debt. I mean, they've got almost $25 billion in debt and all the money pretty much goes to service the debt.
And to shareholders and to executive management, right? Like that's, I mean, and to employee groups. I mean, labor's a big part of it. And I'm not saying pilots and flight attendants and mechanics should be paid less. I'm not going to say that. I think that there are some egregious contracts out there, but good for them. You know what? Good for them. You look out for yourself in the working world.
But at some point, the numbers aren't sustainable and things have to change.
Especially when oil is the cost that it is. And there are harsh realities to this industry. I mean, we're not breaking any news here. The airline business is hard. And I posted this on X, Twitter, whatever, last night. I said, just about every airline that's ever existed has either failed or failed into a merger. Right? I mean, there's few left. In the United States, there's a handful. Yeah, maybe there's 50 Part 121 AOCs that are active. That includes one ship operations and like niche things and cargo operations and everything else. I mean,
I don't even know if there's even 20.
I mean, when it comes down to actual major airlines, you have Delta, United, American, you have Southwest, you have Spirit, you have JetBlue, you have Allegiant, you have Avelo, you have Breeze, you have all the little regional subsidiaries. That's Alaska, that's, Hawaiian.
Yeah.
Which is one operation now. I mean, that's,
and I don't even know if you have non-skeds out there anymore. Is there?
It's a few. I mean, you know, you have your Kalitas and Omni.
Yeah.
And,
the cargo side of it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of non-skeds, but look, it's tough business. It's tough business because the costs are high and the variables that affect the health of a business, the financial variables, they're affected by, you know, world events that are always going, the wheel keeps on turning, right? Like bad things are going to happen, whether it's a pandemic or whether it's a conflict or whether it's just, you know, the economy. These cycles just naturally happen. And airlines are like restaurants. Right? Restaurants don't last long most of the time.
Well, you know, not unless you're making enough margin to put cash back to have cash reserves.
Exactly. I mean,
and that's where Delta and United are right now. They have significant cash reserves. Even JetBlue, for that matter, has somewhat of some cash reserves to.
Well, they have quite a bit of debt as well, though.
They do, but
struggling.
But, yeah.
So what I was saying is you either have to be huge or you have to be niche. Okay. And there's something to be said about being niche. Let's look at Allegiant, for example, right? An airline that I spent 10 years of my life employed by all passenger experience metrics, not winning any awards. However, their business model is niche. They do out and backs. They don't fly on Tuesdays. They barely fly on Saturdays. You know, it's one flight a day.
And they're not flying any of the routes that the majors are on either, right?
No, they're flying.
They're doing these weird little
secondary and tertiary markets. They are flying Allentown to Fort Lauderdale. They are flying Bismarck, North Dakota to Las Vegas. They are flying, McAllen, Texas to Las Vegas.
Yeah.
We're not talking about major markets. We're talking about flying mainline size aircraft in a no-frills configuration from regional feeder airports and offering nonstop service to leisure destinations. Allegiant does not target, nor do they get business travelers, maybe one or two going to Vegas for whatever reason. They target the leisure traveler that wants a cheap flight to get to a leisure destination once a year, once every 2 years, once every 3 years. I had so many first-time flyers every single time I flew when I was at Allegiant. People coming out of Cedar Rapids, Iowa.
And don't they put the whole, don't they sell the whole package, like, you know, the hotel and kind of put the whole, like, sort of an all-inclusive type of a deal.
They certainly did. They certainly did, and maybe they still do. I don't really keep up on the happenings over there, but the bottom line is that they're serving a niche, and they operated very cheap airplanes for a very long time. And even when they moved to Airbus, they moved to cheap old airframes,
old ones. Yeah.
Now they have some newer airframes now. They've smartly taken advantage of market conditions when cheap aircraft were available. You know, hence the 737 MAX at Allegiant now, which is, I don't know if it's online or on its way online, but they were all Airbus and now they're operating MAXes. Why? Because Boeing was essentially giving them away. And they took advantage of that. So it's a lousy passenger experience. Unless you live in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, and you want to go to Vegas, right? Hey, otherwise, you're stopping in Salt Lake.
Yeah, absolutely. San Fran. Big out of Lexington, Kentucky.
Yeah.
They've got like four or five destinations out of Lexington.
I used to fly Lexington, St. Pete, Lexington, Lauderdale, Lexington, Orlando, Lexington, Opelika. Yeah, Punta Gorda. Yeah. So, you know, it's a regional city where you'd have to connect on anybody else, but you can buy a no-frills ticket. As long as your flight doesn't get canceled, you're not going to have any problems. If your flight gets canceled, you may not leave till the next day, or 6 hours later.
So wasn't Spirit kind of like that at one time?
Spirit was kind of like that. And that's the first, in my opinion, that is the first mistake, is that Spirit went head-to-head with the largest carriers in America. Let's talk about where the Spirit bases are, okay? Not just crew bases, but hubs. You got Lauderdale. You got Dallas-Fort Worth. You have Chicago O'Hare. You have Las Vegas. You have Detroit. You have Los Angeles. I mean, those are the ones I can think of. They have lots of, like, little mini hubs.
Yeah. But like, you just mentioned a whole lot of big Delta and American hubs.
And United. I mean, you got Delta in Detroit. You got JetBlue and United in Lauderdale. You got American in Dallas-Fort Worth. You got American, United, and Delta in L.A. You have Allegiant and American heavily out of Vegas, Phoenix. I mean, so you now have a low-cost like product. You have a uncomfortable seat, poor customer service, nickel and dime you to death, you know, on a big yellow airplane that has no customer loyalty. There's no mileage program that makes sense to anybody that has brand loyalty the way that we fly United, right?
Yeah.
So
you're just you've got the people that are looking for the absolute lowest price. And so therefore they're not the same people who are going to go buy a ticket on Delta either.
Right. Right. However, you can't make money when you're selling tickets for $29, especially when fuel is $100 a barrel. And here's the other thing. And you brought this up last week in a totally different context, how they all talk to each other. But the reality is the behemoths, the Americans, the Deltas, the Uniteds, even the Southwests can destroy you if you're small and it won't cost them a damn thing. So if Spirit's trying to sell cheap tickets from Chicago to Orlando, United can say, you know what? We'll take the hit. We won't make any money on Chicago to Orlando. And it doesn't matter because they're making money in a million other places.
Yeah, especially with the premium tickets going overseas.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they can just stomp you out any time. But I don't even think it's that's so much. I don't even think that the majors are going after Spirit in that way so much. Maybe on some routes. But the problem is, is Spirit has the same labor costs as the majors do.
Yeah.
Or you know, similar.
Yeah.
Especially with the pilots. And, I would imagine with the mechanics, too.
Well, and their lease costs. And that's the other thing.
Yeah. But,
I mean, just, you know, cost for CASM, right? The cost per available seat mile on Spirit. I did pull up some stats. So in 2025, their CASM rose to 9 cents, right? From seven and a half the year before. So their costs just continue to escalate. They have a very modern fleet. Like Spirit, their old junk airplanes are mostly gone. There's a few, but for the most part, they have Neos. They have 321 Neos, and they expanded a lot in the push, the aftermath post COVID, but they expanded very aggressively when aircraft leases were extremely expensive. So their cost structure is based on old leases, which they've been trying to renegotiate. But, you know, again, it's been a market where narrow body aircraft, A320 and 321 COs and even 319s for that matter, they've just gotten snapped up immediately. So if Spirit can't pay the bills, someone else will, because those aircraft have been in demand. And then, of course, no fault of their own, Pratt & Whitney GTF, major, major, major hit to Spirit.
Yeah, I think that was a big part of it. The big, the start of the downhill slide, I think, was that Pratt & Whitney issue with the entire,
the ultra low cost carrier model, it relies on spreading those high fixed costs over a dense, frequent utilization, period, unless you have a niche, right? And if you're not filling up your seats, your CASM goes up, and your costs are high, and you don't have the revenue to support it, and it's just a flawed model. Their Latin America model is interesting. It actually makes them, it's one of their more successful models, but it's never an option. I mean, like, unless you're going on vacation in Lima, Peru, which, I mean, it's a cool destination spot, I guess. It's not like it's kind of off the beaten path, but like, we wouldn't fly Spirit to Lima. We go to Lima all the time. Why? Yeah. Because I'm going to fly United or American or Delta.
Yeah. I mean, we're business flyers. Class. They're never going to get the business flyers like us. I mean, there's not any frequent flyer program that's, you know, worth a damn. There's no international, where they have South America or the Caribbean and stuff. But yeah, they're not going to Europe. They're not going to Asia. They don't have the extensive international stuff that's going to be attractive to the business person. It's going to pay the high airfares.
Yeah.
But so just to stop you right there.
Yeah.
You know, going back, let's say, 5 years, maybe longer than that, like pre-COVID, they seem to be doing very well. And at that time, that's when they kind of went into that mode and like built that, I don't know, $1 billion headquarters or whatever it was. They built that big headquarters with a big training facility and spent an enormous amount of money on that. And, then COVID came along and, that kind of screwed the entire industry for a long time. And maybe that was the peak of it all.
Yeah.
When they were doing well and then started spending money on, big, beautiful buildings and all of that.
Yeah. I mean, look, if you're going to spend money, you got to make sure that you're going to be able to recoup those costs. I mean, it's just like any other business. I mean, look at our business. If we're going to make an investment in bringing on a third dispatcher, we better be damn sure that the revenue is going to be able to support a third dispatcher. And if you can't do it, then you don't do it. And there are times where we are crunched. To segue into our guests shortly, there are times where we're all, busting our asses, just because it would be easier to hire somebody, but right now we're dead and, we're feeding all the other mouths that we have to feed and not ourselves because the industry is so slow right now. And look, you add more mouths to feed, you get into an unsustainable business model. I mean, the beauty of our business is if we had to, we could survive with a skeleton crew of like a handful of guys. But look, we bank money when we're making money. And that's what's carried us through. And you just got to be smart when you run a business. And that's just another reason why throwing good money at bad, you know, what is going to be gained? Let's talk about briefly. Yeah, the federal government throws $505. So Donald Trump today said, maybe we'll just buy it. Well, he also said that they tried to merge with People Express under Obama, you know, so take it with a grain of salt.
I think People Express went out of business when I was in high school.
86. Were you in high school in 86?
No, I graduated in 84. So,
well,
close enough. Yeah.
Just about. I don't even remember People Express. So, I
used to send them applications, like, you know, as soon as I got my commercial pilot, actually before I got my commercial license.
Nice.
They never answered.
But look, injecting $500 million, which sounds like $500 million, sounds like a lot of money, right? A lot of taxpayer money. I mean, it sounds like a lot of money, but the reality is it will be gone in 4 to 6 months, and then we're right back to square one.
Yeah, I mean, how much have they been losing per month? I mean, even before fuel went up.
Right now, $100 million a month is the estimate. It's hard to say.
Oh, wow.
So they were losing money. You know, they filed bankruptcy when fuel was $60 a barrel, or oil was $60 a barrel, right? At $100 a barrel, think about it.
Yeah.
And is it going back to 60 anytime soon? I don't think so. Maybe. Hopefully.
I don't think so either. Yeah. I wish, but likely not.
Harsh reality. And, you know, throwing good money after bad simply means, and I don't even know what the upside is, because I'm seeing people across the political spectrum say no, you know, and I'm a capitalist. I may have voted, you know, blue for the last couple of times, but I'm not, I have zero communist ideology. Zero. Right. I mean, we've created free market capitalism is how we've created what we've created. You know, there's no subsidy. We didn't even take, like, we lost our ass in the first 6 months of COVID. We didn't take a single penny of those dollars, exactly. Unfortunately. I wish we had.
Yeah. Yeah. We weren't bright enough to do that, I guess.
No. Well, karma retroactively repaid us by the boom that we had for 2 years afterwards.
But yeah, exactly.
So, look, any type of investment into a failing carrier, they're not failing because of oil. They're not failing because of the GTF issues. They're failing because of numerous structural issues within the company. It is just a loser of a company. If they had merged with JetBlue, if it had been permitted, look, I think it should have been permitted. I don't understand this cherry picking who can merge and who can't. You see the consolidation in media is way bigger than any of this BS that you see at the airlines. Okay. You know, I don't see how. I don't like controls on that. Obviously, I understand that, you know, antitrust and preventing monopolies is better for the consumer. Okay. But it's also not a monopoly. I mean, you don't need 8 low cost carriers.
Well, it would have been better to do that than shell out $500 million to save the thing at this point.
Well, I don't know that it would have saved the thing. JetBlue isn't exactly like in the black.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, who knows? It would have been better off than what they have been with 2 bankruptcies in the last 2 years.
Yeah, and look, the reality is if Spirit liquidates, there's going to be a lot of pilots on the street and there are not a lot of jobs. So that's going to be very, very unfortunate. You guys can call me and Bob. Some of you, if you're cool, we'll put you to work. But no, look, it's not good. I mean, if there had been a merger, some people would be furloughed, but not the entire seniority list, and most likely.
Yeah.
And a merger of those 2 carriers does start getting into too big to fail territory. It really does start raising the question of whether, you know, some form of government bailout structured with like a reasonable repayment and like some legitimate plan that could prove
it to be a good financial move.
Well, the government might be talking to American Airlines sooner than later about that exact same thing with the too big to fail kind of scenario and a true bailout.
Too big to fail, too shitty to live. By the way, speaking of shitty, I'm going to go ahead. We're going to end this here, and move to the interview portion because it's an hour long. But, here's your fair warning. I don't want to hear in the comments that there's too many swear words. If you don't like cursing, don't watch the next segment because,
oh my God.
Listen, it's just the nature of the beast in our company. Like we're busy. We're, you know, we're tense. There's a lot of shit going on. It's a tough environment.
It's a tough environment, and we fight it out, and
we drop F bombs and S bombs and B bombs and C bombs, and I mean, I think there might have only been a couple of F bombs. Definitely a lot of S bombs on this interview. But anyway, it gets spirited.
No pun intended.
But it's all okay. It's it just goes with the territory. You will see.
Yes, you will hear shits, you will hear fucks. Fair warning, if you can't handle the word shit or fuck, if you have kids in the car.
Don't listen to it with kids in the car.
Yeah, listen to it on headphones later because it is entertaining. I was laughing the whole time I was editing
because
it was quite funny.
Oh, it's going to be a great episode. I mean, we got some great guys that work for us, and it's awesome to showcase them. And you guys will see what our everyday life is like.
It really came across just like one of our Monday afternoon ops calls. Didn't it?
It really was. This is why we get nothing done on our ops calls. Or it's very difficult to push through to get anything done, I should say.
It can be. But, you know, that's why we drop F-bombs. Anyway, we'll see you next week. Enjoy the interview. Take it easy.
Y'all have fun.
All right. We've been threatening this for a very long time now. I think probably since the early days of Cockpit Casual, actually. And, you know, people see Bob and I and Wes on social media and they think, well, it's a one man, two man, you know, three man show. The reality is, at Nomadic, when we move airplanes around, it's a team effort and we actually have a large team. And so today we actually have three of like eight key members of our ops and planning team on the pod that we're going to talk a little bit about, how we plan trips. Just the whole dispatch and planning angle of ferry flying. And so we're going to get started with that. Bob, what do you think?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a long time coming, right?
So, yeah, a long time coming. And just to throw in there, these are probably the longest term team members that we have in the company.
Yeah.
Besides you and I. And
for sure.
we'll talk about that more as
actually,
as we
Chris
talk about
actually
the conversation.
Chris and Mark actually predate me.
Yeah.
If you really want to get technical about
it. No, absolutely. from my very beginnings. Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, that's an interesting story that we could cover at some point. But anyway, let me make some introductions first. So, I don't know if the names are carrying over to the screen. Maybe they are. And if they are,
I fucking hope not.
Right. Cause, otherwise Mark, his name is really fucked. Beep. Lots of, I'm going to practice bleeping on this episode.
That's what my family calls me anyway. So,
right up in the corner there is Mark Lawrence. Mark is our dispatcher. He's our dispatch lead. We actually have another dispatcher as well who works remotely on the other side of the clock. He's based in the Maldives. But Mark is based in Calgary. Mark and Chris both are based in Calgary, and Wes is up the road in Edmonton. So
yes.
There's some hockey rivalry and stuff going on. But anyway,
it's more than that.
God. Whose team's in the playoffs? Who's not?
Every time we flush the toilet, the water goes to Edmonton for drinking.
No.
That explains a lot.
It flows south for sure.
Not all you Canadians were so too. Nice. I mean,
you look at Wes.
Canadians, nice.
Talk to each other.
Just the ones in the north are nice, Bob. The ones in the south hate themselves, so they
get so this is basically what our ops calls are like. Just a bunch of us all talking at the same time and getting nothing done. So yeah. We're getting a really accurate look at the insider dynamics of Nomadic.
Yeah, this is how it runs.
In the center is Wes Gardner. You guys probably know Wes from the socials, from Cockpit Casual. We went and flew a trip together a couple years back, and that made it to Cockpit Casual. That was the Antarctic sea ice episode, right, Wes?
Yeah, yeah. And simultaneously, we had that Embraer 175. It got stuck in Honolulu.
Oh, that's right. That was a very high-stress trip. Like, our trip was easy, but we were dealing with a nightmare. So Wes has been around from the beginning at Nomadic. He was part of our previous team as well for a while. Wes is a pilot just like Bob and I. He's rated on a bunch of different aircraft. He's out there flying the line, you know, with us, with our crews, just the same as we do. But Wes also has another commercial role within the company. He's our vice president of commercial for Nomadic. So one of his job roles is maintaining relationships with our large lessor clients and airline clients around the world. He has his own portfolio of clients, kind of like I do, kind of like Bob does. So Wes is like effectively kind of like a third partner in some ways. He does essentially the same stuff as Bob and I, but focused in Asia, because although he's in Edmonton currently, and you could tell by, is that an ISIS flag behind you, Wes?
Yeah. You know, in Northern Canada, we have an affiliation.
I mean, it kind of looks like a hostage video, if I'm being honest.
With more notice, I would have taken it down.
Nah, you're good. Yeah,
what's behind
it's
there?
So we'll get into.
That was his attempt at a green screen. Failed miserably.
Yeah. Actually, since it is a green screen, I may be able to put an ISIS flag behind him with some special effects, VFX tools. Anyway, so that's Wes Gardner. And then next to Wes is Chris Fochuk. Chris is our manager of planning, and he is the guy. Well, he'll talk to you about his job. He kind of does everything on the planning side. He's like, not really a dispatcher, but he kind of does dispatcher stuff. He's, you know,
puts together our quotes, gets our fuel,
drives people nuts.
We just like having him around.
He's the fuel guy.
Piss people off as much as possible.
Yeah. So anyway,
asking for stuff.
Yes. These three guys, Chris, Wes, and Mark, they're the core operations and planning team. And, wanted to introduce you guys and talk a little bit about their jobs. So, first and foremost, like we said in the beginning, Chris and Mark go way back, way, way, way back to before I even knew Bob, I guess, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Back to the beginnings of what time. Was Avia Crew Leasing.
Yeah.
Time.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're getting there. But, yeah, no, I mean, we go back, gosh, over 25 years. From where I was using you guys as a third party for flight planning, and Chris became kind of like my right hand man, like was a full time guy, just handled all of my stuff, but was you know, working for a third party company. So as things evolved through the years, and there was a place to bring Chris into the operation, It was seamless, basically. I mean, we'd been doing the same thing together for over 25 years, and same thing with Mark. Mark actually, was out of his role at those previous companies, even before Chris was, and Mark came along. Mark and I had stayed in touch for years, even when we weren't working directly together. We stayed in touch, and Mark was always like, if there's any way you can find a role for me doing what you do, he was, you know, give me a call. I'm ready to start. So it all ended up working out to where that happened.
Or not, if you ask him. It just depends on the day.
Well, he regrets it every day now.
At least once a day.
So Chris, give us the 2-minute Chris Bochuk story? Like, how did you get into this? How did, like, what's, just summarize, how did you get from like playing hockey in ponds to to this?
From running west into the boards to this.
Do you still have those phone books that you used to strap to your shins in your room there?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Yeah. Yeah. Used to use frozen cow shit for pucks. Oh, yeah. Way back in those days. Yeah. No. Yeah. I kind of started off really just as a bit of a fluke for me. I got a summer job with a company called Skyplan, actually, way back in 1989. And was there for about 10 years and kind of, you know, I was just a kid. So I just went through the whole thing, started off as an assistant. And even before then, I was actually just doing sort of like data collection for the company and putting things together. And then onto like a more of an assistant dispatcher role, did that for a couple, 3 years, and then got into being a dispatcher, then a supervisor, and then moved on to the corporate side of it. Because we were doing at Skyplan, was doing a lot of airline stuff at that point. Mark will remember that. And then we moved to the corporate side. So I went to the corporate side and did that for a few years, and then ended up moving on. You guys remember Nigel Harris?
Yeah.
He moved on to Colt, and then I moved on probably about maybe a year after him, maybe not even.
So and then Chris. Mark, so Chris, let me interrupt you right there, because you're missing a cool story. Oh. The Moscow days.
Oh.
Like,
oh, that's like right. That. You spent some time in Russia, right?
Yeah. So in that period at Skyplan, I spent, we were there. I was there for three trips. Nigel was there for three or four. So on and off for, it was probably about a year and a half or 2 years. And we helped set up basically a flight operations office there. With a company called, they called themselves Skyplan East. The guy that, was the Russian side of that owned actually a couple of Aleutian 76s that fly around freight and stuff like that. And then he ended up, basically kicking Skyplan out of the country. So we had to come home. They they disagreed on a bunch of things, the way the business was running. And you could tell that they were, probably spending more money than we were probably making, and the way Russia worked. And
but that was
where money was coming from.
But that was back in the days of what years was that? Because that was like in the days that like Russia was transitioning from
94.
The USSR. Yeah.
We got there in 94, and I mean, it was pretty wild. We had some guys in our office that were, these really old ex Air Force guys. One guy was a general. He was actually our head navigator, and they literally used to write their flight plans out on a till tape. So like a till tape from a till. So like it's like about 3 inches wide, and they would write it, and they would use, so they roll it out in the cockpit like that. And it would be basically a direct line with NDBs and VORs and waypoints. And they would write all the information in, and that they just put in their pocket. And so at the end of this flight, they'd come back, they'd have like four or five legs, they'd have these tilt tapes they would put out, and they just, that would be their, that was their flight plan. And they, everything was written, was all written. And those pilots, they kind of really didn't care about fuel at that point. They just filled it everywhere they went. And Mark, you'll remember when they would come to Calgary back in those days too. The Antonov 124s and Aleutian 76s, they'd pay cash for fuel. So they'd have like literally suitcase of cash coming into the FBOs and, forking out dough. But back in those days in Russia, everything was cash. But that's what we did. We basically were trying to help them with the same thing, with their airlines and their, operations to learn, how we did things.
And so then you came back to Calgary.
Came to Calgary and then went to Toronto almost right thereafter for a year.
And that was still with Skyplan.
It was still Skyplan. We were doing all, at that point, we were doing all of the work for Sky Service in Toronto and Montreal there. So,
okay.
Yeah, and medevac stuff. And then the A320s, they got the A320s and the A330s. So we're doing all of that flight planning as well. Yeah.
I see. So then how did you end up coming back to Calgary? Or were you?
So that was just a short term deal there. We were there. You remember Ed and Shane? They came with me to Toronto, both of them. And then so it was only a 1 year deal. We came back to Calgary, and then that's, kept working with Skyplan for a bit there, and then did the transition over to Colt, and then, did another, 15 years of Colt, and then World bought Colt, and then did 3 years
and then
of
we
world.
Stole you.
Exactly.
Colt was our,
there's a lot
our,
in between there for sure.
Yeah, Colt was our third party provider of services back when we were smaller. And so Mark and Chris were both over there, and then World Fuel Services bought them, and then they started Spire, which is a competitor to us. And so essentially, you know, our vendor became our competitor, and we quickly stole their best two guys and stopped using them as a vendor.
It's
kind
fun.
Of the short of it.
Yeah, exactly.
We still use World a little bit, but we usually get better pricing from AEG or JetX. Anyway, I don't want to, you know, the intros, I don't want them to take 20 minutes here. So we cherry pick both of those guys, and here they are. Now, Mark, we'll get to you, Wes, last. Mark, basically a similar story, but when did you become a dispatcher? I know you did. I mean, your story is interesting because you did air ambulance flight planning for most of your adult life, right?
Not really. No, I started, I started as a dispatcher. I was working on the ramp here at Calgary for a Canadian Airlines contractor. And eventually I decided to go to school to get my Canadian equivalent certification for dispatch. So I did that. And then in 1996, I went to Skyplan 2, and that's where I met dumbass there. And,
Wes.
Yeah, right.
No, the other one. and that's when I met Bob, who was at.
Holy cow. You still have one of the shirts?
Wow. I still have that shirt, man. Oh, I love that shirt.
That's a relic.
Maybe we need
right
to bring
there,
that
man.
Back and sell it in the gift shop.
Let's do that.
I probably got 500 of them in a bin somewhere in a storage.
Send me some more because I had to cut this. I had to cut the sleeves off this one because they were toast. So.
Your muscles were getting too big.
Yeah, my muscles were getting too big. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I was with Skyplan for 2 years, and then I got offered a job at WestJet Dispatch. I was, I think, dispatcher number 4 or number 5 there. I spent 3 years there, and then Folchak called me and asked me to come over to Colt, which I happily did. Spent 8 years there, I think. And then I went over to Sky Service Business Aviation, helping them out with their operations control system and helping them become better at the dispatch role. Unfortunately, the company decided to shut that down after, I think, 3 years I was there. And the next day that happened, I got hired by the air ambulance division at Sky Service, which is a completely separate entity and a long story one I'm not going to go into. But I was doing that. And then Bob contacted me on LinkedIn and said, hey, we need help. And I said, yeah, man. So I was doing the two jobs at the same time.
So the air ambulance stuff was like Lears, right? Like mostly Lear jets?
Lear 45s. Yeah, all Lear 45s.
Whole world.
The entire world on basically 2 hours notice. So I was working around the clock. I was based in Calgary at home, working at home. From the time I moved Colt, I'd been working at home. So my phone would ring all hours of the day and night. And, you know, I told my boss that I was going to help, you know, the ferry operation. He said, I'm never going to stop you from making more money. He said, so go for it, do it. He said, just remember that your priority is us. And I said, yeah, that's the way it's going to be. So, and then, like I said, was doing both of those. And then in 2016,
yeah,
that air ambulance side sort of folded. And that's when I became employee number one. At Nomadic.
That's right.
That's right.
And I've been here ever since. So
yeah. So Mark, the question I've always had is, I mean, I know your job is very stressful because we're usually the ones putting you under this like massive pressure.
But
you've always had these like these high pressure situations where you have to like make something happen out of nothing, and you know, regardless of what the actual rules are, we're just like saying, just make it happen. Right. So my question is, How do you look so good after all these years? I mean, with all that stress on you, you still look pretty damn good.
For 90.
I'm going to be 62.
For 27.
I'm going to be 62 in 2 weeks. Actually, 62 in less than a week. So how do I look so good? A lot of drugs. I don't drink. I don't smoke anything. But man, do I do a lot of drugs in my... Okay. They're legal drugs, okay? So, like, I don't do the stuff Fochuk does. I don't do that. Because he's nuts. But I am an exercise nut. I have been going to the gym working out since I was 14. And that's my savior and also my family. How they put up with me, I don't know. I mean, they nearly killed me a year and a half ago, but I was trying to kill myself at that point, so it wouldn't have mattered. But yeah, it's, you have to, I needed an outlet, and the only thing at that time was the gym. But thank you for telling me I look good. I mean, I did my makeup for this. I think it's starting to run
a
little bit.
What I was going
to
say,
you're older than Bob, and you look significantly younger there.
Ouch.
Here's the crazy thing. I mean, how long have I've been in the same room as Fochuk plenty. I've never been in the same room as Mark, ever.
No.
In person.
That's wild. Oh, it's a treat.
He was supposed to come to Hawaii that one, but during the end of COVID. And he had COVID.
Oh, yeah. I think I missed that meeting. That was you and Wes had one with a potential customer, but I never got to see you because that was during the masking days. And me being a hypochondriac, I was afraid to even leave my truck. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, what about the trumpet? You haven't mentioned anything about the trumpet. Why don't you play us a tune?
Oh, Jesus. Yeah, I was a semi-pro level. Well, I was playing at a professional level, but not getting paid in high school. Our band won national awards all throughout Canada for 3 years straight. And I was a really good player, but I was never going to be great. So, and no, I'm not playing a tune. Sorry, I won't do that.
Well, we'll have you play a tune for the next Cockpit Casual. There's always trumpet.
Yeah, I know. You know what? It's not like playing the piano or the drums. Playing a trumpet or any brass instrument is probably the hardest thing you can do in music because there's all these things you have to think about to make the thing work. Yep. It's not just a piece of brass plumbing, even though that's what the pros I know and talk to say, oh, it's just a piece of plumbing. Just play it. I'm like, oh, fuck you. Anyways, it's not an easy instrument to play. And it's not like a piano where you've been away for 15 years and you can still play tunes.
Yeah. Uh-uh. I played trumpet as a kid too. And, what happens is your tone falls to shit,
everything goes to shit.
Yeah. Like the muscles in your lips, the ability to really create good tone goes away. Yeah. And you sound like
tone deaf though. Most of the time
it ends up sounding like a harmonica,
Yeah, pretty much. But I mean, you've got to think about your lips, your tongue, your breath, your throat, your lung power, everything and all at once. And that's probably why I do what I do is because I don't believe in multitasking. I don't think it exists, but I can kind of put all that together for this job. It's like, okay. Oh, I got to do this. I got to do that. I got to do this. I got to do that. So it's just like figure it all out. Right. But yeah, I mean, sometimes I put, most of the time I'm able to pull a rabbit out of my ass, for our jobs.
A lot of times.
Sometimes the only thing I pull out of my ass is shit, and I'm sorry about that, but that's the way it is.
You make it work, man.
He does, and there's always a lot of us getting angry and him getting mad at us on trips because we push, and Mark, always ends up coming through and making it work, but we expect the impossible, and he does the impossible. He just puts up a fight along the way, but, it's all good. It's just part of how we do things. Let's move on to Wes real quick, and then we'll get into the nuts and bolts. So, Wes, we're going to end up having you as a full guest someday because your flying stories from your early days of bush flying are fascinating. I've had some great conversations with you for like that went on for 5-6 hours in the airplane that need to come to light for the world, but there's no way we're going to do it in this setting today. So why don't you give me like the 2-minute version? How did you end up here? And what do you do for us at Nomadic?
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to be able to go back to 84 like Comrade Chris there. So it should be pretty quick.
You were still in puberty back then, weren't you?
I was just barely 4 years old back then.
He was only 6 feet tall then.
He came out of the womb 6 feet tall. Actually, sort of looking the way he does right now.
Pretty much. Listen, the beard was darker.
It was, yeah. Listen here, you old bed shitter. Ever since I can remember, I wanted to get into aviation. I wanted to be a pilot. My grandfather was in World War II, flying for the Canadian Royal Air Force, flying PBYs, doing U-boat patrol out of Newfoundland. And just growing up, I remember all the stories, and he loved talking about it, and just got me fascinated. And right from a very young age, I knew I wanted to fly airplanes. So at 16, I bought a share in a flying club and just about didn't graduate high school. I'd skip in school to go fly. And then
your first license was a seaplane license. Is that correct?
No, I got my private on wheels, but I built time for my commercial license on floats. That's right. Yeah. And that was a good decision because at the time it was so hard to find a job in Canada. And most guys were working on the ramp or selling tickets or being flight attendants. And I was fortunate enough to have 100 hours on floats, and I met a lot of the insurance requirements. So I went up north to a place called Thompson, Manitoba, and I got a job flying right away, which was pretty rare at the time. And then
These are the stories that we're going to get into someday. Yeah, like for just sure. You on there, man. There's some hilarious stories.
So just where did you grow up, Wes? Were you in Edmonton when you learned to fly?
Just outside of Edmonton, a place called Spruce Grove. And there was a small airport, Villeneuve, just about 10 minutes away. And that's where I started the flight training.
Okay.
So fast forward through, you know, Northern Canada, I spent about 7 years in the bush, and then a Canadian company sent me over to the Maldives, and I flew twin otters on floats there and moved on to flying Dash 7s and then ended up in Macau, China for my first airline job flying 767s. Unfortunately, that company didn't survive, and a group of us ended up back in the Maldives. We started an AOC there. And that's when I first met Steve. That was your 30 West days where you're trying to play those 787s. What they call them, the teenagers?
7-6.
7-6. That was the first thing. That's right. So I think people don't even know about that. Like right. I never, ever talk about it, but we did venture into aircraft trading and leasing at one point. Bob, myself, and our former partner. And we ended up purchasing three Air New Zealand 767s with some investors as well. And I think that's what really got us talking with you, right?
Yeah. Well, I first met you when we were talking about the 787s, and then we just stayed in touch. And I think I managed to help you out a couple of times coming through the Maldives. You had some crewing issues, and then I ended up starting to do some trips. I did some demos for you for the 767s out of Abu Dhabi, and then did some ferry flights there. And just one thing led to another. I ended up coming on full time eventually.
Yeah, I actually have footage from, I don't know, 2014 or 13 or 14. Remember that one that we picked up in Malaysia? I'm going to have to put it onto this thing, under the pod. We flew a trip from Malaysia to somewhere. We stopped in the Maldives. We stayed at like Gili Lankafushi. Remember that trip?
Yeah, it was from Shanghai to, where did you take it? To the Congo? It's DRC.
Oh, yeah. Wait, did it go to Kinshasa?
That
a surveyor?
Was that one of the surveyor deals?
I think so.
Yeah. But Bob was...
Must have been.
Bob was on... You had two airplanes at the same time, right?
That was a separate one. I think it was a different one. Yeah, it was like a project where we took a bunch of 7.3-400 classics or 300 classic freighters down.
I caught a ride with you from Shanghai. And you overnighted in the Maldives. Yeah, and we went out to Lankinfushi. That's right.
That was wild. That was cool, actually. I have to edit something real quick, but I'm going to put together. I did my first foray into video editing was that trip. Nobody ever saw it because it was kind of crap, honestly. But I made a cockpit casual back then. Like it was like the first of the cockpit casuals just to see if I could do it. And it was that trip. I'll put some of the footage on this episode so people can see it. But, it was, don't judge. It was like, I barely knew what I was doing. I was just starting to figure it out. But, and then you came over and basically Mega went under. You were the DFO over there, right?
Yeah, at the time. Yeah.
And, we ended up bringing you on full time as a pilot and in a commercial role because Wes is much more patient in dealing with customers and people. So what do you do now for like, what is your basic, like a month in the life of Wes look like at Nomadic? Cause it's very different than ours, really.
Yeah. Well, I think it's pretty similar in some many regards, but yeah, you guys actually were sort of saviors there because COVID hit. I was stuck in Thailand and I wasn't full time with anyone at the time. And, you know, luckily at the airline in the Maldives, I was fortunate enough to have some opportunity to deal with the lessors on the technical side, looking for airplanes, sourcing airplanes, and got to have a pretty solid network in Singapore. And once COVID hit and I realized I was stuck, you know, I talked to you guys and said, hey, if I can find you some business, you know, can we work something out? And you guys were all over it. And shortly after that, I think I got the first few trips from my network in Singapore. One of them ended up being another cockpit casual, the 11 Virgins out of Australia. Oh, there.
That's right.
It was one of my first trips.
That was your. Yeah. That was a good one.
Yeah, so, you're the only pilot who wasn't a pain in the ass on that.
Well, trip. I wasn't even on the trip. I was stuck in Thailand.
He was stuck in Thailand.
That's what I mean.
Yeah, he couldn't leave. He missed the Falcon 7X.
Yeah.
And so one thing to add there, Wes, like you've lived a number of years in Bangkok, right?
Yeah, my wife is Thai, so once my kids started getting a little bit older, we were in the Maldives. And I moved my wife and the kids to Thailand thinking that I'd just be behind them maybe a short few months and find something else to do. But so we got a house in Bangkok and we were there for about 9 years. And then just this past August, I moved them to Edmonton.
Yeah. So you're in Canada. Because you've got some ties to some hockey playing, right?
Yeah, I grew up playing. It was, well, every Canadian mostly grows up playing. It's in your blood somehow. And my kids now play. That's one of the reasons why we moved back here. Hockey's it's a big part of my life for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So a day here, I wake up early and try and stay in touch with our existing customers in Asia, try and find new ones, do a lot of cold calling and emails and trying to find new trips to keep these two clowns busy planning and dispatching. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But yeah, it's a relationship thing, right? And I think, Bob, you told me that early on that, you know, you're only as good as the relationships you have with the customers. And so I take that pretty personally and really enjoy meeting these guys. Just got back from Miami or Orlando this morning at 2 a.m. It was MRO Americas and had some really good conversations with existing clients and potentially new clients. So I enjoy that part of it as well as flying.
You do a great job with it too.
One of the things that Wes coming on board did for us was it really freed us up. So we still go to the trade shows, some of them. Like Bob and I try to get to like one, maybe two a year. But Wes goes to all of them. So if you're out there at MRO, at iStat, Air Finance, you know, all these aviation trade shows that happen seasonally all over the world, Wes is almost always at all of them, representing Nomadic, meeting new clients, shaking hands, with existing clients, checking in on the relationships. And Wes has always got his ear to the track, listening to what might be coming, down the road. Speaking of which, what's coming down the road, Wes? Are we going to get busy again or what?
I think so. I have faith that this year it's going to be a bit of a turning the corner moment. It sounds like there's lots happening. A lot of the extensions that happened from the last, you know, 2-3 years, they're starting to come through towards the end of the year. It looks like it could be very, very busy. It's certainly with our existing customers, and then hopefully with some new customers, we'll be very busy going into next year. So
I know that Chris has got a time limit here. I want to kind of get right into the nitty gritty here. So when a trip comes in, from Nomadic, and we've fielded this before, like we basically have two different paths that operations get requested through. 90% of our business is repeat business. It's clients that we've worked with for many, many years, some more than others, some for 20 years, some for 2 or 3. And normally, you know, our goal is when a client comes in, we keep them. We want to keep them happy, keep their airplanes moving. And so the primary way that our business comes in is just through a phone call or an email from our existing contacts at our clients. And then 10% of the time, you know, it's like a breakthrough, like a new cold call that comes in just from our reputation, whether it's via the socials or our presence at iStat or word of mouth. A lot of times, you know, an airline might, you know, be buying some airplanes from a lessor off lease, and they'll say, who do you guys use to move your airplanes? And then they generally recommend us. So something comes in. First thing that happens is it goes to like an on-duty, like triage kind of email. And then Wes, myself, and Bob are the three guys that really handle everything as they come in. Chris too, actually. Fochuk sometimes fields that, especially if we're out on trips. Chris is kind of like the guy that mans the phones, mans the email desk there, with like, you know, the first queries. One of us puts it into a proprietary system that we developed, and that triggers a series of flight planning tasks. So right off the bat, I mean, obviously we don't want to give away the keys to the castle, but when we get a request, it's important that we know the aircraft type, the origin, the destination, the details surrounding why the aircraft is moving. Those are the very, very, very basics. We plug that information into a system. It triggers a chain of electronic events where emails get sent, prompts go to everybody in our planning team. The first person that anything goes to is Mark. What do you do when you see a trip come in, Mark?
Actually, it goes to Chris first.
Oh, does it?
Yeah. I mean, I see it. I see the email. And then Chris will usually contact me and say, okay, here's a little bit more detail. And then I will start the route planning process, which is basically determining how we're going to get from point A to point B. Generally, the least painful way possible, because doing it the most economical way just doesn't work because of the things we have to go through. So Chris will get it, and then I'll do up the test plans once they're finished, and I send them back to Chris, and then he'll start doing the quoting process.
So let's talk about test plans, and let's talk about how the routings work. So for one, I mean, we've talked about routings a lot, right? We have our places that we like to go because we have relationships with the handlers. We know that permit acquisition is painless or painful in some cases. Sometimes it's unavoidable. I assume you have like just files and files of gouge for dealing with different locations. But more importantly, the biggest issue that we always have to overcome is timing, because the permit application process could take time, validations, overflights, so on and so forth. So even more than route efficiency, we need to look at our ability to execute on short notice once all the documents come in.
Yeah, that's right. So, again, it's looking at a flight planning engine and determining how are we going to do this, because we're probably going to have to, you know, get minimal notice to go. So I will, from, you know, past experience and history of doing this, is just, okay, we're going to go this great big huge dog leg and do that instead of, you know, having to spend 3, 6, 5, 7 days sometimes, to get other permits. So we're a lot of what we do is not cost effective. And I'm sure my airline cohorts in dispatch, which I'm not really a dispatcher anymore. I don't consider myself that, but they would go, what the hell are you doing?
You're more of a chaos manager.
Well, yeah, exactly. And no, that's exactly what it is. It's like, just make it work. And I had a discussion with a fellow at Eurocontrol a while back, and he's like, you really fly those routes? I'm like, yeah, we really do. And he's like, wow. So yeah, it's chaos. Yeah. But yeah, I do have a pretty good memory. Not everything is in writing, but I keep emails. And last time I checked, I have 2 gigabytes of emails going back to 2016 when I started here. And also some from my previous days, which I've managed to remember and write notes about. But yeah, I don't have a lot of stuff written down. Actually, probably nothing. It's all in emails. And I just go, yeah, okay, I remember how to do that. So
one of these days we have to pump all those into AI and have them just have it just create. Yeah.
And then you kick me out to pasture and I don't need to be around anymore. Thanks a lot, asshole.
Well, I don't know about that. Nobody wants to actually do it. I mean, the reality is though, if something happened to you, Mark, like we would be pretty much fucked.
Mark, I mean, you're more than just information. You actually are
kind of entertainment, right?
Well, you're kind of the police too. I mean, you do keep us out of a lot of trouble.
I try.
So a lot of times we're planning a trip that might take place in 3 weeks, a month, 2 months, 6 months. How do you deal with wins like on test plans?
They're irrelevant 99% of the time just because of the routes we have to take. Right. So efficiency for us, especially when I'm doing it 3 months out, I don't even pay attention. It's like, okay, today it's a 90 knot tailwind and that's the plan still works going the route that we have to take. That's what we get. And whatever happens, day of flight happens. When it gets hairy is when the flight plan is tight to begin with. Mm-hmm. And then 3 days before flight, the flight plan doesn't run anymore because we're having to do these dog legs to get, you know, to avoid the countries we don't want to overfly. So that's when it gets difficult and the things we have to keep an eye on.
And one of the ways you deal with that on the planning side is with, assigning like a fuel penalty, like a bias to the flight plans, right? So we use 12% generally on test plans.
Usually it's about 12 just for contingencies of what might happen down the road, especially when this is going in 6 months or 3 months or whatever. So we'll reduce it. We'll reduce it, you know, as we can when the trip actually happened.
Yeah. We've got the advantage. Yeah. I was going to say we have the advantage that we've had so many years in business that we have a lot of historical data, you know, if not on paper in our heads that we know what, you know, pretty much what it's going to be.
Yeah. It's when a weird aircraft comes up, that we haven't dealt with very much before, or I haven't dealt with. I mean, I think I've planned just about everything, from, you know, twin otters. I mean, I think we even went lighter than that at the sky planning cold days, but, pretty much know what an airplane can do. But yeah, it's the weird ones that kind of get the ones that we don't deal with very often, like some of the newer ones. The 350, the 380s and those that we don't deal with, that those are a different circumstance. But, you know, generally going in, if it's a 737 anything, I pretty much know what it can do. Yeah. And it's basically going to fly the same route that we've always flown.
Right. And our flight planning system is not the latest and greatest. Like,
it is not.
Right. And that's because the flight planning systems out there that are the latest and greatest are tailored for people that own their own airplanes. So they have performance numbers, data, all the actual weights for each MSN.
Yeah. I don't think we couldn't. I mean, the system is antiquated. And the vendor, who I'm not going to name, knows that. But it does what I need it to do. It's ugly to look at, and it's like literally 1980s technology, but I can get it to do what I need it to do. And that's all that matters to us.
This is why Mark's picture is vertical on this thing, because his computer is so antiquated that he uses for flight planning. It can't run Riverside.
Yeah, no, I'm actually using a, piece of shit iPhone. So, you know,
so after the test plans are filed away in the trip, things get moved to Chris, and then it's Chris. Chris is the one that does what we call a TCE, a trip cost estimate. Sure. Chris, why don't you walk us through the basics of the TCE process? We've got a route now. We've got flight plans. What happens next?
So yeah, even before that, like Mark was saying, depending on the situation, you know, where we're flying to, we might do several versions or variants of a TCE on the same route, or the same city pair, but a different routing, depending on what's going on, especially now with what's going on in the Middle East, you know. You know, weather could be another thing too. If there's a hurricane or something and we've got enough time, we could plan around it, but also plan one through it in case it gets delayed, you know. So we have these variants. So we kind of know, we've got options, I guess, when the trip actually, we get a date, so we know what's going on. So I basically get that information from Mark, the test plans, and the test plans would give me all the information, the fuel, which countries we're flying, basically everything I need to do the trip cost estimate, which is not actually a ton of information from the flight plan. But anyway, I'll go through and I'll look at all of our fuel vendors to get the absolute cheapest price of fuel I can at every location, because fuel is fuel. It's all the same stuff, right? It's everyone sells the same product. So, And I feel like all of our vendors give us, you know, good service as well. So I don't really, you know, I don't have a favorite or anything. I literally go out and get the cheapest possible fuel. Because obviously our trips are all non-revenue. So we want to do it the cheapest possible. And that's my motivation too, with these trip estimates, is because they're non-revenue, we want for the customer to be able to get from A to B the cheapest possible way. But as Mark will attest, there's things that get into our way. And one is like geopolitics, weather. I mean, it could be the airplane itself could have an issue that, you know, creates a situation where we can't do the normal route or whatever. So, so I basically collect all that information and I put it all together into the estimate. And then I pass it over to you guys, who then review it again. I also, in the estimate, it includes everything as well as crew travel, crew days, you know, crew catering,
costs, hotel, navigation fees.
Yeah, nav fees, all of it. The RBSM costs, import and export for customs, you name it. All of that, all those costs go into the trip estimate. So really have to be careful that we're including everything that we get charged for, clearly. And because some of these estimates, especially in the last few weeks, they're getting really large, all because of fuel. But, yeah. You know, just some gross numbers coming out now on fuel.
We're also often competing against, against competitors. And there's not a ton of like ferry companies that do the volume we do. I don't know that there's anyone right now that does the volume we do. But the reality is a lot of our clients are getting their corporate policy dictates they have to get three quotes. So we always have to keep in mind, we got to keep costs. Like, we know what our margins need to be for us to make a profit. You know, I mean, we're not running a charity and, you know, we can adjust the sliders a little bit. But ultimately, you know, we want to provide the best value to our clients. And sometimes that becomes a problem because our competitors, you know, maybe don't have as much experience as us. They're not necessarily leaning into the pitfalls that we expect on a certain route. And so it's not always an apples to apples quote.
Rarely is.
It's never been like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes our customers just take the lowest bidder and learn the hard way. And sometimes they come back to us and say, I don't understand why you're $12,000 more than the other two quotes. And then we can look at it and say, well, we operate on a call sign. So navigation fees are paid by us. Whereas our clients flying on a call sign, the owner of the aircraft's going to get billed for nav fees over the course of the next 3 or 4 months. And so just know those fees are coming. They're just coming to you later and directly.
Well, so, Bob can attest. I think Bob's probably seen back in the day, probably saw bills that were upwards of 2-3 years old.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
From that Africa, piece. Oh, man. Yeah.
For
and
sure.
Really just, yeah. And the
yeah, they show up 3 years later. It's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. I used to hate those phone calls. Hey, Bob. Yeah.
But also,
speaking of which, I still think we owe the I think we owe a company in India some money still from a trip 2 years ago. I forgot about that.
But also, I think it's important to know, too, that because we do this all in-house, we have that past experience and things of timing. You know, I'll come to the guys and I'll say, you know, look, we're going to get the SFP on Monday, and the customer really wants to leave on a Wednesday. You know, if you look at the most efficient route possible, it's impossible to do because you need 4 days lead time for a permit or this or that. So we have to adjust the routing to accommodate the customer's request. And I think when they get quotes, you know, some of our competitors don't have that past experience to consider that in there. So, you know, it's always a challenge explaining why sometimes we're a little bit higher, but once they understand, you know, and we do a good job, you know, we've got some really loyal customers.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, you know, one thing that I failed to mention earlier when we talked about when we brought everything in-house, when we poached these two guys and they became, you know, our employees rather than a vendor, you know, the biggest cost savings there is these flight planning companies, and there are third-party flight planning companies. In fact, almost all of our competitors utilize some of the flight planning third-party flight planning companies. The big issue is nothing ever happens as you plan on a ferry flight. It never goes the day you plan. It might be later, might be earlier. It's usually later, and then it might be later again, and then later again. Winds change, something change. Everything changes. And the problem with third-party flight planning companies are whenever we make changes, third-party companies charge you revision fees. And, you know, when we would get a trip cost estimate from Colt back in the day, you know, we would say, okay, we're going to move this airplane from Arizona to Ukraine, and it's going to cost, you know, $77,000 in all the ancillaries, fuel, permits, all that, ground handling and all that stuff. Okay. Well, when the trip delays 4 times, and then delays en route because you have a mechanical, that $77,000 becomes $94,000. Very, very, very quickly. And so bringing things in house, like these guys are salary, they're on salary. So they're getting the same paycheck regardless of what happens. Sometimes it's an easy job. Sometimes it's not an easy job. You know, I would say sometimes Chris makes and Mark makes $100 an hour. Some days they make 50 cents an hour, depending on how much work goes into a trip. Right.
Yeah. It all evens out.
The same goes for us, honestly. Yeah. I mean, you know, we don't take salaries. Like
we've literally been doing this our whole lives, right? Like Mark and I literally been like, you know, just working weekends and evenings and nights and everything, birthdays, anniversaries, Christmas, our entire lives. It's kind of just become normal. Well, you guys too. Yeah. I mean, the pilots do have to do the same thing, right? Nights, weekends, holidays, everything, but you get her done.
Yeah. There's no set hours. But that's the way our lifestyles have been for for decades.
That's right. Yeah.
So when a trip is happening, when it is in the works, when we're actually, when Bob and I go out and we take off and we're en route to, you know, Uzbekistan, who is on duty at that point in our ops? Let's talk about that a little bit, because flight following is a big part of it too, not just the beforehand.
Well, Gareth, Mark and I, like the North American day, and in the evening, MJ takes over at night because he's in the Maldives. So he's will, you know, deal with everything at night. But during the day, I mean, when we're really busy, sometimes it takes both Mark and I to be dealing with, you know, multiple trips. But sometimes if it's just the two of us, we're just making sure that, you know, we're following the aircraft and setting the movements and making sure customs is updated and making sure that, you know, your catering is there and all those things to make sure that you guys can just keep trucking along, you know?
So, yeah, movement messages are something that people may not even understand. So every time an airplane reaches a station and departs a station, there's a list of client representatives, handlers. Who else is on that list? I mean,
that's most of the clients, all of their folks and ground handlers. That's really 99% of them right there would be those two. And sometimes there's, you know, 20, 30 emails on there. So
yeah,
letting a lot of people know. Yeah. Cause there's a lot of people that have eyes on the airplanes that, you know, maybe not have access to flight radar or, you know, any of those, what do you call them? Tracking softwares.
Yeah.
They're not even always on all the track. I mean, sometimes, especially if we're departing out of like, you know, Iqaluit or something like that, like it doesn't even pick up until we're climbing out. You know, along the coast of Newfoundland.
Yeah. But we're watching you guys basically taxi out and taxi in when you get to where you're going all the way, you know, until you stop. So yeah, it's important that we keep an eye on, you know, where you guys are at all times. And then we pass it on to MJ when he comes on the evening and then he takes over and does the same thing at night.
And let's talk real quick about dispatch, paperwork. Like, so every single trip, every single leg, we get a blast email with a ton of PDFs on it. What's included in those?
So that'd be obviously your computer flight plan. That's probably the most vital thing. And then weather, NOTAMs, both textual and graphic. And then, your fuel releases, information about your handlers, which now we have our own system where you can look that up. Instead of, you know, adding to the paper, there's also your customs clearances, especially in the US, your APIS reports, your Gendex, things like that. So yeah, it, you know, depending on the length of the leg, it can be, or the length of the day, because you can do multiple legs a day. I mean, the package can be 60, 70 pages long. So
yeah, and we typically like to have paper with us. I mean, we have the electronic copies. That's what we use, but iPads fail, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, stuff happens.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And just something to add to the process here. We have two admins, Pat and Emily, who are bringing docs out of emails and processing those docs, you know, before, so that Mark and Chris can actually start using them, you know, for permits or whatever reason. You know,
It's really hard to not miss something, because like every time somebody says something, I'm like, oh, we didn't talk about customs export. We didn't, you know, there are so many like aircraft documents, right? There's so many different RVSM. There's so many little boxes to check on each trip throughout the trip where we're always collecting documentation.
And with our different registrations, right? Then that adds in a whole nother different set of documents, because some will have this, some will have that. Yeah.
Ferry permits have limitations. PTFs have inspection requirements and limitations. you know, we sometimes come across like situations where the insurance, you know, document, like, so the airplane certificate of insurance, certain geographical locations, certain countries, certain regions require specific wording on the insurance policy. So often,
Turkey, yeah.
Yeah. So like Mexico. We'll get Mexico, Turkey, even EASA.
Yeah. On and on.
So Chris is like Chris is a guy that, you know, when documents roll in, they get posted up on a Slack channel, which is how, you know, we use Slack we separate each trip, and all the appropriate people for each trip are on this central communication Slack channel. Mark, it's the bane of Mark's existence. But because it's always ringing, it's always ding, 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 24/7. Yep. I mean, whether we're flying or not, a lot of times it's these guys harassing each other about hockey or something, but it's mostly like some sort of chaos going on with a trip that's going to happen or already happened or something like that. So Chris is like the fail safe when it comes to that. Like Chris will look through a insurance document and he'll be like, you guys are scheduled out in 2 hours, but this insurance document doesn't meet EASA standards. So we're not leaving Bangor until you get a new insurance document, you know?
Yeah.
There's a lot to it.
Yeah, a lot of reviewing of paperwork beforehand and making sure it's all in order. And because once you start the process, if something's wrong, then you got to go back to the client, and then it just, they don't like that, and it delays us. And so, yeah, it's a lot of pre-review and making sure all the ducks are in a row for sure.
A lot of pieces to a puzzle.
Yep.
So who's easier to deal with on a trip, me or Bob?
Wes.
Thanks, Mark. I'll pay you later.
I know. Okay, thanks, buddy.
Canadians stick together.
That's right.
Yeah, King even Canada, after baby. They harass each other, they still always yeah. stick together.
Yeah.
I get grumpy as hell on trips, and I know that, like...
No, really?
Yeah, Mark.
Hey,
Mark
easy there, really fucked. Let's be real here.
Mark is ripped the hell out of me many times.
My son just handed me a note here. He's listening in the background, and he says, there's one thing you forget to mention is how many times everyone says fuck per trip.
A lot. This episode is going to, like, we have some sensitive listeners, so there's going to be like an explicit lyrics, like, you know, I'm going to pull one off of like a rap album from like the 90s, and I'm going to put it on the cover of this. Explicit lyrics on this.
Just put in your date of birth before you watch this podcast. Have your parents
think exactly. Are you 18 or older?
The tipper drawer warning.
Wes's kids can't watch this ever. No. My granddaughters will never see this. You know, things like that.
It's okay, Mark. Only like 1,000 of hardcore av geeks are going to be seeing it. So no, it's
the first hour.
Look, the reality is this job will make you crazy. Like the job of ferrying airplanes. Like we're a very capable unit. We can do the things that even airlines with 50-person dispatch centers have trouble doing. And it's because everybody is good at their job. Everybody knows what's next. We kind of know what to expect. We learn something every trip. But the reality is you got to keep it light. We bite each other's head off. Chris Fochuk's like the most mild, nicest guy on earth. You know, we've screamed at each other on the phone. I mean, it happens,
Chris,
right?
Chris did not scream back. I don't believe
it. No. I just scream at Chris. Chris just starts talking loud and slow and like pacing my conversation.
Very, very definitive talk from Chris. Ooh. And I know I'm in trouble. I'm like, okay.
Mark, I'm sure has had pipe bombs like ready to send to my house.
Oh yeah.
You know, it's all good. Yeah,
daily.
Look, I love these guys. I mean,
if you ever see a Ryder truck parked out front, Dave, it's Mark.
Run quick. I know your address. I know where you live. I've got it Googled. Be nice to me.
These guys.
That's one of the reasons. That's one of the reasons MJ came on is because you guys just about drove me to suicide. So because I was working 24 hours a day and literally lost my mind, and we had to bring MJ on to cover the night shifts because there were times when I was going 3 or 4 days without sleep.
I was sleeping in the basement for weeks.
Yeah, that's because your wife hates your guts. But
we do have a company psychologist now, by the way. So I don't know if you saw
that.
Well, it's a couple podcasts
ago.
Dr. Powell.
Oh, well, shit. Give me your give me your card. Actually, you know, my shrink is pretty good. So
she's going to watch us and say, no, there's no help in Mark.
There's no help in me. It's been far too long.
She's like, lose,
she's
like,
very
lose
zen
number.
And no. Very calm.
Yeah.
All right, guys.
But anyways, thanks to MJ, my friend, for being my reliever. And he's doing a good job.
So. Yeah.
No, we'll get MJ on one of these days.
Yeah. It was a tough start to this business, starting in, 21, when we started Nomadic?
Yeah. But it was all of a sudden.
Yeah.
It was a lot. There was no prep. It was like all of a sudden it went from 0 to 1,000,000 miles an hour overnight.
Yeah.
So. It's kind of a blur, to be honest with you. Like there's definitely a couple, 3 months there where I think it was just like, whew, what just happened? Like,
you should,
you know,
maybe one day we'll do the 4 hour podcast where we talk about, I mean, nobody would even believe how crazy that transition from Jet Sets to Nomadic was.
You got to get MJ on sometime because he's got quite the story too.
Yeah.
Yeah, he does. He's a really great guy and I'm glad we have him. So he's got quite the sense of humor.
He and I go back many years, like long before you guys had met him. When I flew the Twin Otters on floats, he was a cabin attendant that used to tie my airplane up to the dock. And then, and then he just progressed. He got into dispatch and crewing. And then when I helped start that airline in the Maldives, I brought him over as an assistant. And he worked all the way up to director of OCC at the time we went out of business. So I was glad that he was available when Mark said he needed someone.
Yeah. That worked. Sure. Yeah. We're going to have him. We're going to have Pat Roa on here.
Pat's in the sim to continue right now.
This. Yeah. Everybody's got some great stories and are some super great people we have here.
Well, so this episode is kind of like the intro, kind of first, you know, getting everybody on, getting to know our group. But ultimately, I think down the line, I mean, we had a lot of pods to make, and we're going to have subject matter to deal with where we're going to want to bring different, you know, you guys on individually. I'll get you guys some better mics and cameras too.
me I look great. What the hell?
Well, you're just vertical, Mark. I mean, that's the biggest issue.
There we go. Better? We don't want any horizontal.
That's way better. Now you're sideways. You're anti-gravity.
Sideways. What side? What's
sideways? I'm from Philly.
I'm going back to vertical.
I'm from Philly.
And then Wes, has so much good stuff. Like Wes is going to be kind of the third host that comes on here, with, you know, the three of us. He could replace either one of us. Just, you're going to see a lot more of these guys in the future and more. So thanks for coming on today. I know.
And
Chris,
if you don't like me, please note in the comments down there somewhere, get rid of that jackass. They'll know who you're talking about.
They're going to love you, Mark.
Please comment. I'm looking forward to the comments.
100%. Yeah.
The famous Mark Lawrence.
Yeah.
The one and only.
Mark's going viral.
The only one.
We got to wrap it up. Chris has got to go pick up his son before his wife divorces him. And
again.
That didn't actually happen, by the way.
No, it didn't.
She lied to me?
Yeah.
Damn.
Oh, my God. Quite a dynamic here. Any final words, anybody? Bob?
No.
It's a good thing we didn't have eight people on today. Nobody would have gotten a word out.
No kidding. Yeah, we were talking about bringing everybody on board this. That would have never worked out.
Hey, Bob. So,
it's great. Yes, sir.
Send me a box of those.
I'm going to go look for them, and I'm going to send you more.
Put them on the channel. Put them on the website for sale.
Yeah, I did find a big stack of stickers.
Yeah, if you can get me the graphics, Bob, I will. I'll put some retro Avia Cruise, the original heavy metal transport, up in the gift shop at omdgear.com.
Yeah, that'd be cool. Yeah, let's do it. I'll find the old vector files or whatever I had.
Sweet,
awesome.
All right, guys. Well, I will probably be talking to you here soon in a more official capacity.
Yeah. Let's get back
Thanks
to work.
For
all right.
Us on.
All right.
Awesome.
Bye bye.
Look forward to the next one.
All right. See you guys.